Welcome to the May podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinchem. The May 2012 issue is on the topic of vascular fistulae of brain and spinal cord. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Aaron Amar of the University of Southern California, Los Angeles, speaks with Dr. Giuseppe Lanzino of the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. They discuss Dr. Lanzino and colleagues' article, Minimally Invasive Treatment of Intracranial Hemorrhage, which appears in this month's issue.
This is Arun Amar from the University of Southern California. It's been a privilege to serve as one of the topic editors for this month's issue of Neurosurgical Focus, which concerns vascular fistulae of the brain and spinal cord. These are some of the most challenging conditions that neurosurgeons encounter. The evolution of venous drainage that causes dynamic changes in pathophysiology accounts for their highly variable natural history. Furthermore, there are a variety of treatment options available, such as observation, surgical disconnection and/or resection, radiosurgery, embolization, or various combinations. And this adds to the complexity of their care. In combination with the relative rarity of these lesions, such factors have precluded systematic study and definitive statements about their management. The current issue of Neurosurgical Focus aims to fill the knowledge gap about many aspects of central nervous system vascular fistulae. The first set of articles explores the topic of spinal dural AV fistulae. The next ones concern carotid cavernous fistulae. And the last group addresses several other facets of CNS vascular fistulae and includes the article featured in this month's podcast entitled Curative Onyx Embolization of Tentorial Dural Arteriovenous Fistulae. The senior author of this report is Dr. Giuseppe Lanzino, professor of neurosurgery at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Dr. Lanzino, congratulations on producing this paper and thank you for the opportunity to speak with you about it. Could you please begin by just summarizing the objectives, methods, and principal findings of your study?
Sure. We have prospectively collected data on our intracranial dural AV fistula that we have seen over the past 4.5 years. And we have identified a subgroup of patients, which is the focus of this article. These are patients with tentorial dural AV fistula and exclusive retrograde cortical venous drainage. These were fistulas that until a few years ago, surgery was really not only the best, but truly the only effective strategy. But with the introduction of Onyx, we have found that these patients quite often can be treated effectively and safely with transarterial Onyx embolization. In this article, we report the details on 9 patients with various types of clinical presentations, but characteristically with fistula of detentorium and retrograde parenchymal venous drainage. And these patients were treated with Onyx embolization through a transarterial route. And in 6 of 9 patients, we were able to achieve complete obliteration of the fistula, which was subsequently confirmed on a follow-up catheter angiography. In 2 patients, we achieved almost complete obliteration with very faint delayed filling of questionable clinical significance, while in 1 patient we failed to achieve a cure and that patient required surgical treatment.
I understand. So as you mentioned, all of these fistulae had exclusive cortical venous drainage, and of course the absence of a recipient venous sinus is one of the characteristics that makes tentorial dural AV fistulae different from others. This has implications both in the natural history, which leads to perhaps a higher risk of bleeding, as well as constraints on the type of treatments available. You mentioned that you were obligated to come from the transarterial route instead of transvenously. You mentioned that you used Onyx. Could you please explain the use of that embolic material as opposed to other liquid agents such as N-butyl cyanoacrylate?
Yes, Onyx is a liquid embolic agent that is dissolved in DMSO. And unlike NBCA, it's easier to control as an embolic agent because it can be injected under prolonged period of time. And if the material starts going into territories that are not the target of the embolization, the process can be stopped and restarted usually after a minute or two, and until the material starts going toward the target vascular territory. So I think Onyx was actually originally introduced and approved for pre-surgical treatment of arteriovenous, parenchymal arteriovenous malformation, but really what I found in my practice where it has really changed our approach to the treatment has been really in the treatment of some of these dural AV fistulas with exclusive cortical venous drainage, where in the past when we tried to embolize with NBCA, which is quite often much more difficult to control and operator dependent, we were not always able to achieve a permanent cure because the NBCA would stop short of the proximal cortical draining vein, and the occlusion of the proximal portion of the draining vein is the most important factor which eventually leads to complete the closure of this fistula. In our experience, Onyx has changed the way we approach this subset of dural fistula because it has made possible a cure from a transarterial route and has avoided the surgery, which in our institution was really the mainstay of treatment for this particular subset until a few years ago.
And in your series, you utilized both Onyx 18 and Onyx 34, which have different viscosities and compositions based upon whether or not you could achieve a wedge position.
Is that correct? That is correct, and it's hard to say whether or not there is really any true base on this practice, any truth. There is definitely a theoretical base in the sense that Onyx 34, that is more viscous, was often preferred as the first material in order to obtain a so-called plug around the catheter, and then was followed by Onyx 18, especially if we were if the microcatheter was in a position that was distant from the target. In a situation where we were in a wedge position and therefore injection of the material tends to progress only in an antegrade fashion, then we would prefer to start from the beginning with the Onyx 18. Again, it does make sense from a theoretical point of view, but whether or not it's a true effect, there is such a difference between the two types, I'm not in a position of saying for sure.
Well, I would agree with you that although the bench tests do demonstrate differences in viscosity, I think in clinical practice it's often difficult for us to distinguish the behavior of the two formulations. Another technical question for you. You prefer the use of the Echelon microcatheter versus the Marathon, and of course both of those are supplied by the company that makes Onyx, and they're compatible with the dimethyl sulfoxide solvent of the Onyx, unlike other microcatheters. Could you just elaborate a little bit more about why you prefer the Echelon?
Yeah, the preference is based on the simple fact that Echelon is our preferred microcatheter for aneurysm embolization, which is by far the procedure which we perform more often. And therefore, we are very familiar with the performance of the microcatheter, even in very small vessels, such as the ones that supplied some of these fistulas. In our practice, we don't perform a lot of embolization for parenchymal arterial venous malformations, and therefore, we are less familiar with other types of microcatheters. And I think this brings us to a fairly important subject, is that nowadays with all these devices, we have so many choices available. And at the end, you wonder whether or not there are true differences between among all different devices. And whether or not these differences are so important that overcome the fact that once you become familiar with one specific device, then you can anticipate the performance and you get a particular feel for that specific device. And that applies also to open surgery, where we have thousands of tools available, but the vast majority of us at the end, when we think about 98% of the operation is done with no more than four or five tools.
I agree with you completely. It's always vital to have a lot of experience with the handling properties of whatever tools that you select. So I agree. I'd like to ask, you found that the key to success in the treatment of these fistulas was the access via a posterior division of the middle meningeal artery. Did you have any experience in trying to embolize other branches, and were they as successful?
We have experience in trying to embolize other branches, but we seem to run consistently into two main problems when we try to embolize through branches other than the posterior branch of the middle meningeal artery. We have done several through the occipital artery, or if there is supply from the superficial temporal artery as well. The problem we run into is that it is very difficult to safely and consistently achieve a very distal microcatheter position because of the tortuosity of these branches. And because of the lack of distal position, we have been often unsuccessful in obtaining the same degree of complete obliteration which we obtain with the catheterization of the posterior branch of the middle meningeal artery. I think that the posterior branch of the middle meningeal artery, when available, provides two key factors that are important for the success of the procedure. It is a relatively straight branch, and therefore there is a very good response of both the microguide wire and the microcatheter while catheterizing this branch. And because it is relatively straight, it also allows us to achieve a distal position very close to the fistula, but equally important in a vessel that distal enough where the size of the vessel often matches the microcatheter, and therefore you are in a wedged position. And when you start injecting, quite often you see that the material tends to progress in an antegrade fashion, and the issue of reflux is minimized. Of course, when doing catheterization through using the posterior branch of the middle meningeal artery, it's absolutely critical to being in a position distal to the petrosal branch that goes to the facial nerve. But in our experience, for this type of fistula has been really the key to success, and definitely we have been much less successful for this and other fistulas when we are trying to use other branches, or if the posterior branch of the myelomeningeal artery was not available.
Now, in this same issue of Neurosurgical Focus, my colleagues and I published an article that perhaps calls into question the issue of the durability of onyx embolization. And in our series, there were several vascular fistulae that had documented penetration and permeation of onyx into the draining vein, which, as you pointed out in your article, is considered the sine qua non of embolizing vascular fistulae. Yet these fistulae in our series appeared cured by angiography initially and then recurred. So I suppose it's a necessary but not sufficient condition to achieve occlusion of the draining vein or recipient venous sinus. Do you have any comments on that? Has that happened to you, and has that guided your protocol for imaging to rule out delayed recanalization of fistulae?
Yes, I've been worried about that, because the issue with the onyx is that the way it behaves both in vitro and in vivo is that it starts coating the wall of the vessel first, as opposed to the true lumen. And it has changed, this observation, it has changed definitely our approach. Like in cases where we do surgery, we do usually a postoperative angiogram the day after, and we are happy with that angiogram. In patients that have been embolized with onyx, we try to do a follow-up either 3 or 6 months after to confirm that the embolization is durable and still the cure is maintained. And I think that we have learned two important things. Number one, it's easy as you start embolizing that as soon as you see that the onyx starts filling the proximal vein, you do your transarterial run, the fistula is gone, and it's easy to stop too early. So what we have learned, that even when we see that we think that we might have occluded the proximal portion, we tend to continue to inject additional embolic agent with the idea that hopefully we are filling more of the lumen, because we are not sure if the angiographic appearance at first is just related to a relative coating of the vessel wall without a true obliteration of the lumen of the vein. And the other thing that we have learned is that one of the first cases I remember, we did the final run, there was no filling, we did the complete angiogram, we were happy. When the patient, one of the patients came back from follow-up, we could see that there was a very faint, delayed, persistent filling of the vein. So what we have learned is when we do our control angiogram, really let the angiogram run in the very late and even after the late arterial phase to make sure that there is not still a very faint filling of the vein. Now, whether or not this faint filling has any clinical significance, we really don't know, but especially in these fistulas that are quote-unquote dangerous, of course, it's nice to get a complete angiographic obliteration. But I agree with you, that angiographic obliteration has to be confirmed after a few months to make sure that it's somehow permanent.
Well, I think you've offered several insightful comments about the treatment of vascular fistulae, and I want to thank you once again for contributing such a wonderful article. It really enhanced the quality of this month's Neurosurgical Focus. So thank you one more time, Dr. Lindsay.
Yes, thank you for the invitation, and congratulations on an excellent issue. I've learned a lot reading the papers published this month.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. This concludes our podcast for the May issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the June issue, when the topic will be skull base CSF fistulae.